told me, it's going to mess with your life. We were driving down Glenway Avenue in the left turn lane, about to pull into Cancun, the restaurant, not Cancun. Cancun Mexican restaurant. I was with my mentor, and we were shoring up plans for me to enter into my PhD program. And when you enter into something like that, or anything that you're looking forward to, that you feel good about doing, you always look at things through rose-tinted glasses. How great it's going to be, how good you're going to do, the achievement, the esteem. And right then and there, Tom told me the truth. All that stuff's great, but it's going to mess with your life. And he was right. And I've discovered over the years, not just with that, that everything that is actually worth doing, everything worth putting your time, talent, resources, effort into doing, will cause and require pain. Now, in honor of today, today, of course, being Puppy Bowl Sunday, we got a puppy in November. That's our human pup with our dog pup. The dog is named Pippin. Yes, we named him after the Lord of the Rings character, Pippin, Peregrine Took, Fool of a Took. We have to use that often with him. We got another picture just to really make the awe go with his face here. I know, I always know what I'm doing a little bit. But this last picture is the reason I wanted to throw Pippin and introduce. That's our little end table. That's where my drink is supposed to go. He is not a decoration or meant to be on a tabletop. I left the room for a brief moment, and I came back in to sit down, and there he was. Now, for those of you that have ever had puppies before, you know that they just don't do things that you expect them to do. They don't stay off tables. You have to train them to not go potty in the house. Oh, and by the way, as Angie keeps reminding me, they're little land sharks. Not a week goes by where we don't have little bite marks and scratch marks because he confuses our moving hands for toys. We've got to put the toy in his mouth. Literally, everything worth doing will cause or bring about pain. Sometimes literally, sometimes figuratively. But everything worth doing requires effort, can require hurt. And that's true in all facets of life. Any parents in the room? It doesn't matter what phase you're in. We have a 5-year-old. You just saw him on the screen. You get to age 5. You're like, when do they mellow out? Angie read somewhere that 8 is a really difficult time. And then I've got friends that have teenage kids, and apparently that's nearly impossible. And then I know my parents probably think having adult children's impossible. I mean, they got to deal with me, you know? So, if you have a job that you want to do well in, you go to work every day, put your blood, sweat, and tears in it. It's hard. You have good days and you have rough days. You have failures. Things don't always pan out the way that you want them to on the way to whatever success. In fact, if you ever want to succeed at something, it probably will require you to be able to stomach failure. And failure brings pain. Now, we're going to be looking at a story that's a bit of a miracle story that follows a miracle story in Mark chapter 6 today. And while it's a miracle story, I'm just going to tell you up front that the focus today is really going to be on the discipline of prayer and reliance on God. And I hope that you'll see that, because oftentimes when we read Scripture and we look at the wonderful things that Jesus says and the wonderful things that Jesus does, we get caught up in the wonderful nature of the story, and we miss the point. And the point is actually hidden in two spots. And I have to confess to you, the one of them was going to be the key driver of the sermon. And then over the weekend, I was hanging out with John Rice and his two sons at Lake James for the men's camp. And we were sitting at a table eating lunch yesterday with Dr. Frank Weller from Great Lakes Christian College. And John asked me about a verse in this passage. And then Dr. Weller turned to me and said, "You're going to need to go hit the commentaries again tonight." And again, as with all things, it messed with me. And so I hope it messes with you this morning too, because in this story, it follows Jesus after he feeds the 5,000. And if you're familiar with the story of the 5,000, wonderful. If you're not, I'm just going to summarize it. I'll tell you the story here. Jesus and his disciples are on the other side of the Sea of Galilee, and they're in a bit of a remote place where people can't exactly easily access food. You know how we take for granted food? You're like, we can just get in the car, drive down the road. If we don't have anything in the fridge, we'll just run to McDonald's or something like that. There wasn't a McDonald's in sight. There was nothing to eat, and there weren't enough food items amongst those that had brought something to give food and sustenance to everybody that was there. As the story tells us, and if you're familiar with it at all, Jesus does this miracle before 5,000 men. And the text specifies men, and in these stories, the gospel writers have a tendency to point out that that was just the men. So when we say that Jesus fed the 5,000, he actually fed more than 5,000 in this miracle story. Now, the disciples, as I said last week, and as you might be picking up throughout the story, if you're reading along, if you're doing our all-church study along the way, you might realize that the disciples get themselves fixated on the mission, the achievement, the esteem that they get for being the special disciples of Jesus. And when you get fixated on these sorts of things, you tend to have a "we don't have time" attitude. And so we talked about that last week. I kept using the phrase "got a minute." This idea of slowing down and trying to be present for the people in your life that need you in the way that Jesus slowed down to be present in the lives of the people that needed him, which in the case of Jesus, we all need him. But the disciples aren't interested in slowing down. So in the miracle of the feeding of the 5,000, they tell Jesus, "Hey, these people need something to eat, and we got to get going, so why don't you send them on their way, Jesus? They'll listen to you. That's why they came out here, to hear you in the first place. So just get them out of here." And Jesus, well, he stumps them. He turns and he says, "Well, why don't you give them something to eat?" And so they find a boy with 5 loaves and 2 fish. And Jesus lifts his head up to heaven, and he lifts the baskets up to heaven. I'm sure every Jesus movie has depicted this story. And he prays the prayer to his Father, and suddenly there are baskets full and baskets full. And when they collect the leftovers, there's baskets full afterward. And so after this miracle work, after all of this work that Jesus is doing with the people, he decides it's time to go back across the sea. And so he does something. He tells his disciples, he commands them to get in the boat and to go across. And that's where our story today picks up. And this is what it says in Mark chapter 6, verse 45 through 47. It says, "Immediately he made his disciples get into the boat and go on ahead to the other side, to Bethsaida, while he dismissed the crowd. After saying farewell to them, he went up on the mountain to pray. When evening came, the boat was out on the sea, and he was alone on the land. When he saw that they were straining at the oars against an adverse wind, he came toward them early in the morning, walking on the sea. He intended to pass them by. But when they saw him walking on the sea, they thought it was a ghost and cried out. For they all saw him and were terrified. But immediately he spoke to them and said, "Take heart, it is I. Do not be afraid." And then he got into the boat with them, and the wind ceased, and they were utterly astounded, for they did not understand about the loaves, but their hearts were hardened. So there are some things about this story that we miss because our eyes lock on to the same thing when we read this story that the disciples' eyes locked on to. Let me ask this. Have any of you ever seen anyone walk on water? No? I'm not the only one? Okay. So most people don't see people walking on a body of water. And the disciples were no different. Except they were seeing something. And they probably all looked around at first like, are we just seeing things because the wind? No, I see somebody walking on the water. And so immediately they jump to, it's a ghost! You ever cause someone to see a ghost? It's when you walk out of an entryway and they're walking walking into you and they don't know you're going to come around the corner, and then they go like that. I hate when that happens to me, and I think it's hilarious when I do it to other people. And it's never intentional. It's just one of those things. So Jesus is walking on water, and they're terrified. Okay, so this is the part of the story that we're amazed by. And it's hard not to be amazed by it because it's just something that doesn't happen. This is something that kind of only Jesus does. And by kind of, I mean only Jesus does this. But the thing is, Jesus also is the only person that feeds 5,000 plus the women and children from 5 loaves and 2 fish. Jesus, along the way, has been teaching with authority. Everybody recognizes this. He's been healing individuals of their ailments and of their spiritual maladies. And people are astounded and awestruck by his power and his authority that clearly supersedes the religious leaders. But what Jesus is doing in these two stories takes the cake. And the funny thing about it is, spoiler alert, it still isn't the biggest miracle in the story. We'll get there on Easter Sunday. But for now, the disciples are witnessing these miracles. He's able to feed thousands upon thousands of people with nothing, virtually nothing. And then after that, when he tells them to get on the boat, he's walking on water. And they didn't expect it. That's why they didn't say, oh, it's just Jesus. They thought it was a ghost. They couldn't see who it was. So we're just like them. We get captured by the miracle. We get awestruck by it. And oftentimes, if we're honest with ourselves or we're human, we might even have a bit of disbelief. But if you focus on what the disciples focus on, you miss the point of the story. See, the point of the story was already told to us early on. See, Jesus tells his disciples to get on the boat and go to Bethsaida. Now, if you're familiar in the Gospel of John, even though Simon Peter and his brother Andrew have taken up residence in Capernaum, where Jesus made his home base. We talked about that in week one. I can't believe we're on week six of this already. But the point is that Bethsaida is the birthplace or original home of Peter and Andrew, according to the Gospel of John. It actually means fishing village. And it's not too far away from Capernaum. So he sends them on their way to Bethsaida, but he doesn't get in the boat. Why? Well, it says he goes up to a mountaintop or a hillside area to pray. If you're familiar with the Old Testament at all, anytime you see individuals that are shown to be faithful and reliant on God, they oftentimes pray for his guidance before making their next step. And Jesus is the perfect model of humanity. He's what we should, ought to, could, but failed to be. And so he goes to pray to the Father, as he often does, going to a lonely place to be in the quiet presence of the Father. Of course, the disciples aren't going to a quiet place. They're in a boat. And if you get into the text here, it's the wee morning hours. We're talking 3 to 6 a.m. They're probably tired. And the last thing they need in a culture where people are already afraid of being on the water, I think I've probably said before, we take for granted going to the beach, but in that time, the water was chaos. And even though they were fishermen and used to being on the water, this time and what was coming was not what they were used to. Because we're told an adverse wind. So think windstorm. Think rocky waters shoving their boat from side to side. And so they're already tired. And now they're tired, but their adrenaline is rushing. And Jesus picks this moment to say, oh, I prayed enough. I'm going to go walk over and meet them. Now, I'm going to clue you in. This is the part of the story that my good friend John pointed out and asked the question about. It says that Jesus intended to pass them by. Now, when he asked me this yesterday, my first thought was, when I was in like a teenager, and, you know, when you're a teenager, you worry about running into people, you know, like maybe you're embarrassed, you're going to be seen with your parents. I mean, oh my gosh, well, I have a parent. You see someone that, in my life, I did go through bullying, so maybe you see someone that you want to avoid. So you're in the store, and you go hide behind the clothing rack or the end of the aisle cap. I'm the only one? Okay. Well, see, you could read this and say, well, Jesus intended to pass them by, but that's not what's going on here. If you read the book of Exodus, we're often told that God passes by the Israelites in order for them to be led by him. When Jesus intends to pass them by, his intent isn't to avoid them. It is to get out ahead of where they're going, so that they'll fix their eyes on him and that they will safely get to land where they intend to go. But of course, going from point A to point B may be worth it, but it will mess with your life. Why? Because anything worth doing will cause stress, pain, and turmoil. And when you face the stress, the pain, and the turmoil, do you know what you need to do? Not rely on yourself. Not try harder. Not turn back around. You need to fix your eyes on God and follow where he leads. And do our disciple friends do that? Absolutely not. No, they don't even recognize that it's Jesus. They instead get terrified, thinking that he's a ghost. So Jesus thinks he's going to pass by just the same way, because despite the dismay of people, that Jesus in human form is God in the flesh and the God of the Old Testament. Don't fall for the heresy, okay? He's the same today as yesterday as he will be. So Jesus is doing the God thing, passing them by to lead the way, and all they can do is get freaked out by the moment. And I'm sure that we are just like them if we're honest. We all have the moments. And so they're freaked out by the moment. And their first conclusion, by the way, is it must be a ghost. Never mind that they just saw this guy feed 5,000 plus. Never mind the miracles they've seen. Never mind the dynamic teaching that they've heard and the ways of the kingdom being ushered in. No, it must be a ghost, and we've got to shake in our sandals and just hope that the boat doesn't get crashed by the waves and they're done for. So Jesus, realizing that they're frightened and terrified and not getting the hint that they should be following his lead, he stops on the water, because that's what you do when you're just walking on the water. You just stop and stand there for a minute, and you say, as Jesus always does, "Behold, it is I." You know, I love the language there, you know. "Fear not." I don't know why he sounds like that in my head, but so he stops them and he tells them to not be terrified, and they end up making it back. But we're told at the end of the passage that even though they're astounded or astonished, which, by the way, isn't a good kind of wow, it's a what did we get ourselves into kind of wow. And the reason we know that is the type of astonishment is defined for us by Mark. Mark tells us that they did not understand the loaves, meaning they didn't understand the point of the miracle before. Why? Well, because their hearts were hardened. In the language of this whole story, I'm just going to tell you, our gospel writers, they record some great history of the life of Jesus, but man, they're theologically astute. Because if you're reading this story through Old Testament eyes, it's screaming at us. Not only is Jesus God in the flesh doing the passing by thing, but you know who the disciples resemble in this story? Who else might you recall in the book of Exodus that his heart was hardened? Like, thank you. After like 10 plagues, "Let my people go." The hardness of heart is a colorful way of saying that they're stubborn. They're in it for their own thing. They're in it for their own acclaim. They're in it for the reasons they think they should be in it and not the reasons that Jesus has called them. And if we're being honest, we all get caught up in our own lives being in our own thing for our own purposes quite often. And when we do this, the last thing that we often do is go to God. He is often our last resort. Now, before I vilify God being our last resort, let me remind you that the woman that had the flow of blood for 12 years also went to Jesus as a last resort, and Jesus still commended her faith. So he still loves you, even if you're a knucklehead like the disciples, and I think we mostly are. I know I am. But nevertheless, their hearts are hardened. They don't understand the loaves, because they're so focused on what they get and what they're bringing to the table, no pun intended, that they don't understand the purpose of Jesus' miracle. Why would Jesus perform a miracle in a destitute place to give people food? Well, number one, he loves people and he wants to provide for them. But number two, he shows that he's God in the flesh. The Gospel of John calls Jesus' miracles signs. Why call them signs? Because signs point to some reality that you need to know. Don't blow through the stop sign. Green means go. And when you see Jesus do a miracle, it means he's God in the flesh and you should rely on him. In fact, you should not just rely on him, but you should do what he does. And before the disciples got into trouble with the adverse winds, what was Jesus doing again? Praying. So what will you do the next time? And yeah, there will be a next time. The next time life gets rocky. The next time the waves hit you. In our small group this past Monday, we were looking at the story of Joshua, and we were looking at the story where the Gibeonites basically tricked the Israelites into thinking that they're not breaking God's rule to not make a treaty with the surrounding nations in the lands that they're supposed to be given. And so they get tricked into this sort of thing, and they end up being called upon to go to battle with the Gibeonites. And we're doing this right now media study that Louis Giglio is leading. And the whole theme of this study in Joshua, or this particular week, was the audacious prayer of Joshua. Because as the battle's going, he decides that he is going to pray a wild prayer. They're winning the battle. God's come to the plight of the Israelites, even though they unwittingly broke his rule, showing his grace. The disciples definitely need grace in our story today. But the prayer that he prays is that God will make the sun stand still. Why? Because if night falls, you got to stop the battle and pick it up again. And Joshua just wants to get done with it. He wants to win the day and go home to sleep and move on the next day. And you know what God does when he prays that prayer? He answers it. The sun stands still. And they win the battle. And so we started talking about these audacious prayers. And one of the things that it got me thinking about, as my friend John's been leading us through this Louis Giglio study, is that I've always struggled with prayer. I've struggled with prayer because I'm a bit of an intellectual person. The Bible study part of the spiritual discipline, that comes kind of easy for me. But the reliance on God, the giving up control, the not having anxiety about what's to come or what was or what that might be, that gets to me. And oftentimes, I can be a last resort person. And I definitely can fail to do those audacious prayers. But I'll tell you this. In seasons that even our church is going through, where we've had death and illness and people in the hospital, I do find myself in those moments being forced to have those audacious prayers. And I know what we typically do. We try to play nice with God, try to say all the right words, you know, all the qualifications so that we don't overstep. And one of the things I've learned over the years is that God is God. He's the God that can walk on water. He's the God that can make the sun stand still. My prayer doesn't mean he's going to say yes to my ask. But that never, ever, ever, ever means he can't. And I'm not here to tell you why he does or doesn't. But I can tell you that he always calls us to go to him as we walk along our path. He always wants us to come to him, even if it's with the audacious prayer. Why? Because nothing in life that is worth doing will alleviate you from the pain and trial of getting to that destination. The times come and you will need God. You will need him to pass you by and take the lead, because you might not know where you're going. Even if you do, you might not know how to get there. And even if you know that, you might not know what the journey is going to be like. But I can promise you this. He does. He's already ahead. If you'll just lock your eyes on him and not be terrified by the moments. We all end up like the disciples at times. We step into things that we're excited about. We think this new job is going to be great. We think the promotion will be wonderful. We can't wait to see the face of the newborn. We can't wait to meet up with our friends. We can't wait to go out and do that outing that we were planning on Friday. You might even have big aspirations for the Super Bowl tonight. Sometimes the wings don't turn out the way you plan. Whatever it is, big or small, you need God. He has called you to follow him. That's what the call to discipleship is about. That's why this series is called Disciple. Because ultimately, the story of the Gospels is not just the story of Jesus. And even if it was just the story of Jesus alone, it would be good enough, because it's the greatest story ever told. But the story, and I want you to keep this in mind as we continue on this series, the story is asking you what your journey of being his disciple will be like and look like. Will you be the faithful person that reaches out to touch the cloak of his garment when you are in need, trusting that he can do what you need him to do? Or are you going to be those on his inner circle that are so terrified that they won't even look at him because they think he's a ghost? And here's the best part about it. Even if you end up like the disciples, and we all do, he will stop. He will turn his gaze back to you. And he will say, "Here I am. It's going to be okay. Get up and follow me." So do as he does. Learn the lesson of those who didn't. Take stock of where you've been and where you're headed, and rely on him through prayer. Hopefully when he came in, you got a communion cup, the bread and the juice today. I know I sound like a broken record when I say it. One of my all-time favorite stories is when Jesus is in the Garden of Gethsemane. You know, Jesus not only was God in the flesh, but he was always consulting the Father. And on the night that he was betrayed, he not only instituted this meal that we share together as a church family to do in remembrance of him, but before he was arrested and shamefully tried and crucified, he knelt in the Garden of Gethsemane to pray. And his prayer started out like I think any of our prayers would start out. "Lord, take this cup from me." Everything worth doing brings pain. That doesn't mean that we want to go through the pain. And neither did Jesus. But you and I were worth going through it. And so the prayer didn't stop at "take this cup from me." It continued, "Yet not my will, but yours be done." And Jesus, obedient to his Father to the cross, yielded to the will of the Father and gave his life up for us. That's why we take communion each week, because Jesus relied on the Father even to lead him where he didn't want to go. But he loved you so much that he was willing to go. And so this morning I ask that you pause and remember what he has done for us. And after that moment of reflection, we'll take communion together as one church family. I invite each and every one of you to take this bread as Jesus commanded. This is his body, which was given for us. Take and eat. And likewise, I invite you to take and drink of this cup. This is his blood, which is poured out for us. Please pray with me. Dear Lord, all of us are in different phases, different spaces, different moments in life. For some, our place is in a hospital bed. For others, their place is at the bedside. For some, it's white knuckles on the steering wheel, just hoping we get where we want to go with snow and sleet on the road. For some, it's navigating their next step at work. For some, it's the navigating the next phase of a child's life. And for others, it's just growing closer to you and taking that next step of faith. No matter what our next step is, no matter where it is you've called us to go, wherever you've called us to be, we need you to guide us. And so, God, I pray that as simple as it is to just say pray, prayer is hard sometimes. Prayer is hard because we don't always know how you'll answer, and we all don't always know why you'll answer the way that you do. But one thing is for certain, we need you and we need reliance on you. And so I pray that for each of us, no matter what lies before us, in the highs and the lows, that you will be our guide and that we will take the cue of your son Jesus and rely on you and lead others to do the same. We thank you so much for loving us. I pray for those in the room that haven't made that first step to be baptized and to be your disciple. And I pray that if that's that step that they need to take, I pray that you will stir in their hearts to make that decision, because the truth is that while you teach your disciples that the Son of Man has no place to lay his head, to those same disciples you say, I'll make you fishers of men. The journey may be difficult, the road unpaved, but it is totally worth it. And so I pray that you will stir that in their hearts. Thank you so much for loving us the way that you do. And it's in your Son, Jesus' name, we pray. Amen.